Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. It's called pregnancy mortality or maternal mortality. Women dying while pregnant or within 42 days of becoming pregnant. The most recent numbers collected by the CDC say nearly 700 women died during pregnancy in 2018. And for black women over 30, the risk of dying during pregnancy is four to five times higher than that of white women. Why is that? And what can be done about it? Well, joining me to talk about this on this Medical Monday is health advocate and activist Dr. Jamila Parrott, a board-certified OBGYN and productive health and family planning specialist. If you have a comment or a question about this, if indeed you have been touched by these difficult statistics, we want to hear from you. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Dr. Parrott, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. So much to get to right now. From a layman's perspective, when you hear about women dying during childbirth or during pregnancy, a lot of people often associate that with pop culture movies and 19th century medicine. But this is 2020. Why is this still happening?
Unfortunately, there's not one clear or specific explanation for these inequities. Without a doubt, you said it right. This is a crisis. This is a public health crisis, and unfortunately, this is not new. The tragic deaths that we hear of most recently, Shazia Washington in New York, but also women who are dying around the country during pregnancy and childbirth is something that has been plaguing our community for centuries. And we do know that Black communities face more barriers and more restrictions, and that as a result, we have less access to high-quality care in our communities. We're also less likely to have providers in our communities. And we also are more likely to have to travel for care. Black women are more likely to be uninsured or underinsured and have fewer resources in order to pay for it. But the thing that's most important about these stark statistics is that it's not our Blackness that's putting us at risk. It's not the fact that I'm a Black woman who is over 30 that puts me in that category of being high risk. It's my racialized experience of being Black in this country. And so analyzing these really tragic deaths and these stark statistics, both for pregnant people, but also for the babies that we have, is a complicated one, but an important one to think through.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about pregnancy mortality, why women are dying while pregnant or giving birth. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One of the more high-profile examples of a near-death experience. Venus Williams, during her pregnancy, talked about almost dying in the process of giving birth to her daughter and indeed becoming her own advocate. But here's the thing, because based on what you were just suggesting, that there have been issues related to communities that may be economically challenged, socially challenged, even geographically challenged. Venus Williams is none of those. So from that perspective, talk to me a little bit about that. And does it still have something to do with her needing to be her own advocate, even with all of the resources that she has at her disposal?
Absolutely. I think that that was really a watershed moment for those of us who have been advocating for equity in maternal health for many, many years. For someone like Venus Williams, and we also heard Beyonce's story about not being listened to and having this near miss experience during her pregnancy and childbirth. And what it was really clear to, I think, the rest of the world is something that was clear to many of us who've been doing this work for so long, is that we cannot earn our way out of it. There is not enough money, there's not enough fame, there's not enough fortune that will protect us from this risk. And the question around being an advocate for yourself is grounded in agency, autonomy, and power. So Serena Williams and Beyonce had enough power in that moment to be able to exercise it, to force them to be listened to. When we talk to pregnant people or folks who have recently delivered, who had these near misses, one thing that is a common thread is this not being listened to and the need to be able to advocate and have either on your own or having someone there to advocate on your behalf. You know, medicine is not uniquely exempt from the legacies of racism and oppression that touch every other field and industry in this country. And so when we look back at the history of medical education, of medical training, of medical evidence, we see very clearly that there is a thread of racism and racist thought that that really follows all of the things that we learn in our training. And as a result, Black women are often cared for differently than other folks when they show up. And this is one manifestation of those inequities. And so Serena Williams had this experience during her pregnancy and after her delivery and was able to advocate for herself, which she believes, and I also believe, truly saved her life.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about pregnancy mortality or maternal mortality, women dying while pregnant or while giving birth. Why is it that women of color, particularly African-American women, are leading at the top of that list? Let me go to Massa from Capitol Heights. Massa, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning.
Yeah, go right ahead.
But first, let me recategorize how you define people, because no such thing as African-American. We are Aboriginal North Americans. So let me just make that clear. So, and then when you get to women dying from birth, I want like everybody to YouTube the King Alpha Plan, YouTube Rex 84, YouTube Agenda 21.
Whoa, stop. Let's make sure that we stay on point here. Look, can talk to me specifically about this, about what we're discussing here. I don't want to get too far afield here. Go ahead, Massa. Just make your point, please.
I'm talking to you about what we are specifically discussing here.
Mm-hmm.
But you just have to be open-minded enough to listen to what I'm saying instead of interrupting me.
Go ahead and make your point. My show, right, you got 30 seconds.
Like I said, you have to properly inform yourself. So you have to inform yourself about the King Alpha Plan. You have to inform yourself about Rex 84. You have to inform.
Okay, we don't. I don't even know what that is, and I think I'm gonna have to let you go because I need to stay on point. But thank you so much for your phone call. Also, I did misspeak. I mentioned Venus Williams. It's Serena Williams who had those issues, doctor. So I wanted to make sure that we were clear about that. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One of the things that that I'm sure you're here in D.C. and you remember just 2 years ago, the D.C. Health came out with this report about maternal mortality rates in D.C. And let me just read you the summary, although I'm sure you're familiar with it. It says that the U.S. has the worst maternal health outcomes in the developed world. Currently, The nation's capital is facing one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the country. D.C.'s maternal death rate stands at 36 deaths per 100,000 live births. Only four states have worse maternal death rates, and D.C.'s rate is more than 50% higher than the national average. Doctor, talk to me about where we are since that report 2 years ago.
Well, D.C. has made some strides in working towards addressing maternal morbidity and mortality. One of the things that D.C. did was created a Maternal Mortality Review Committee, which is really important legislation, and took action to be able to count what's happening. You know, we talk a little bit about how we define maternal mortality, and it's difficult to count because across states, across jurisdictions, those numbers are counted differently. Some are very focused on the time during pregnancy and immediately after delivery. Some of the counts include up to 1 year postpartum. And the postpartum period, up to 1 year, folks are at increased risk as well. And so when we look at the inequities in D.C., one, we're fortunate enough to be able to have support to be able to begin the work of counting and investigating these deaths. The second thing that I think is important to understand, whether we're talking about D.C. or any other place where there are inequities in health outcomes for our communities, we have to really be very clear that, like all health outcomes, pregnancy complications don't exist in a vacuum. So you aren't at just determined once you get pregnant that your health is at greater risk. It's your health throughout your life that increases your risk. So access to quality health services, even before you're pregnant, during your pregnancy, and after your pregnancy play a role. Your ability to access healthy food and clean water. You know, I grew up in D.C., and so this is home for me. And so D.C. has always existed as a tale of two cities. And so we see huge income inequities in this city that have always existed, certainly since I've lived here my entire life. And so what that means is that your risk of being able to make it through your pregnancy intact, to deliver your baby safely, to go home with your child and raise that child and any other children that you have in a safe community, often is determined by the circumstances in which you live. Now, what I will say,
go ahead.
In addition to that, though, is that it isn't just this income inequity. So I'm so glad that we had an opportunity to talk about Serena Williams' birth story. Because it's not enough just to say we have to fix economic inequity as a way to address maternal mortality. Yes, we have to do that. And we have to begin to dig deeper in the way that we're providing care in the city when folks are showing up in our offices, in our hospitals, in our clinics, as a way to really come up with solutions for addressing these inequities.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about pregnancy mortality, women dying during pregnancy or during childbirth. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call again at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This is fascinating to me. Tyrone calling from D.C. Thanks for – do we lose Tyrone? Tyrone, definitely give us a call back. Let's go to Vincent. Vincent, on the line. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Number one, has anybody looked at the genetic component in terms of the causality of the problem? And number two, has there been any studies that looked at black women who were cared for by black OBGYN docs? You would think that inequity in care would be somewhat different, but again, we all learn the same. I'm a physician myself. We all learn the same medical school knowledge, and that's, you know, who controls most of that. So again, two questions: is there any genetic causality to the issue? And the second question is: has there been a study that looks at care from black physicians in terms of infant mortality rate, and along with the afraid of women who are pregnant and have children?
Vincent, thank you so much for those questions. Dr. Parrott, your thoughts?
I love these questions. I'm going to start with the second one first. This question around racial concordance is sort of the way we talk about it in research, right? Racial and ethnic concordance. So does the person who needs care, Do their race and ethnicity match up with the person providing care? There was a really wonderful study that came out of Oakland that didn't look at pregnant women, but looked at Black men who were seeking care. And when they were seeking preventive health services that was being administered or provided by other Black male physicians, their outcomes were improved, right? And so we know that racial concordance matters. We haven't seen a similar study to the same degree with pregnant Black women and Black OBGYN physicians. But we have seen lots of other information about what pregnancy and labor support looks like when care delivery looks different. And what I mean by that is benefits from having social support during your pregnancy and delivery decrease these negative outcomes. So having support of midwifery, midwives, for example, and doulas who are labor support people who are more likely to be providers of color and people of color than OBGYNs. The thing that's really embedded in that question that I want to lift up that is really critical is one line that the caller said, and that was about how we all are receiving our medical information from the same place. There is a hierarchy in the knowledge production in medical school, and he named it correctly in saying that that hierarchy is determined by power. Someone is giving us this information, is dispensing it, and teaching us how to then take care of our own community. And so
Dr. Pruitt, let me stop you just for a moment because I got to take a break. But please do not lose your train of thought. I want to make sure that you continue this point as we head to a break. But we are going to continue taking phone calls. Raisha calling from Bowie, you're going to come up next. Just remember, we are talking about pregnancy mortality, women dying while pregnant or giving birth. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR, but this conversation continues on Sirius XM, Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Stay with us. Do not hang up if you're on the line. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. On this Medical Monday, we are continuing our conversation about pregnancy mortality, women who die during pregnancy. My guest is health advocate and activist Dr. Jamila Parrott, a board-certified OBGYN and reproductive health and family planning specialist. Lines are open. Please be patient. We're going to get to as many phone calls as we can at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Dr. Parrott, please continue your point about the medical education that so many people, such as yourself, OBGYNs, are getting as it relates to this issue.
Sure. Thank you. So we really, the bottom line is that we have a long way to go in terms of how we get to a place of equitable care for all of the people that we take care of. And medical training is an important place to do this work, right? And so talking about racism and bias in medical care, acknowledging the racist frames inherent in our medical history, teaching our students, our trainees, and providers ways to how to identify the ways that white supremacy is showing up in our institutions and in our work. But it takes much more than that. It's not just matching the race of the patient and the provider that's going to get us over this hump. To the first question that I'm going to answer now, second, and the second part is the genetic component. And that's been a very strong argument around or reason given as to why Black women and Indigenous women as well, I want to lift that up, experience disparate rates and maternal morbidity and mortality, this idea that there is some genetic component. And the reality is that there isn't a lot of truth to that at all. And there's a wonderful book called Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington, and she writes about this, this myth of medical distinctiveness, this idea that disease or illness manifests uniquely different in Black people has been a source of experimentation, of medical study. We saw it used as a way to explain away the Tuskegee experiment, for example, this idea that it's a genetic component and not the racialized experience that we have in the world that makes a difference is one that we need to work to actively eliminate. Now, with that said, that racialized experience has specific effects that we call weathering, right? And so the experience of racism on black people, on indigenous people, and the way that we move through the world and the way that we're received through the world starts to wear away our resistance. And so we see greater incidences of chronic disease, chronic illness in many of our communities. And this weathering as a result of racism plays a component in that.
I want to thank Vincent for his thoughtful question. I'm going to go back to the phone lines at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. That's Raisha calling from Bowie. Thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
No problem. I think that with most issues with the mortality rate for black women is the simple fact that when we say something is going on with our bodies, or we say, hey, I feel a little off, and a doctor dismisses it as, oh, well, you're probably doing this, or try this, instead of actually really taking the time to check it out. I also think that when you're at the hospital and you're saying, oh, my baby looks a little yellow, a little bit more yellow, and they send you home, those are certain issues and times when you have to really advocate for yourself as a black woman. I appreciate Serena Williams putting that out there that, hey, look, you can stand up and change doctors. You can move different areas of your life if you want to. You don't have to stick with that particular doctor. If they make you feel uncomfortable, change them like you change your underwear. And I mean it just like that. Because there's no better feeling than having a healthy mom and a healthy baby, supposedly for OBGYN. That same feeling should relate to a mother, whether she's black, white, whatever. The other issue is I find that nowadays, when my mom had me in 1986, she had a C-section. She didn't leave the hospital for 7 days. Now we send the people home in 3 days, and moms are fine with that, not realizing that there are certain steps. You just had major surgery, or even with the vaginal delivery, you're going home the next day. You just pushed out a whole person. Your body needs to rest before you go home and take care of your other children. Like, there are certain things that I see black women running back to kids, running back to work, running back to all these things, certain things that we are hoping not just for insurance to cover, but maybe the state and national government saying, hey, we need to give mothers more time at home with their children to relax that time. Because we do have high blood pressure, diabetes, all of these things that pop up in the 16th to 24 week of pregnancy.
Well, Raisha, I thank you so much for your passion and input to this conversation. I want to have Dr. Parrott respond to what you shared with us, because you just shared with us a whole textbook of things that we all need to pay attention to. Doctor?
Yes, you did. Thank you so much. There were so many really important points that
Absolutely.
I just want to lift up. One, listening to the person that's in front of you. One would think that that is an automatic skill that every healthcare provider comes out of medical school or training with, and that is not the case. And what that caller identified so clearly is absolutely the truth. Black women are less likely to be believed when they complain, when we complain about something that's going on. We're less likely to be trusted to know what's happening in our own body and in our own lives, right? And so all of this, again, is rooted in the discrediting of black bodies in this country, and we have to say that over and over again. The other thing that I think is really important that the caller mentioned is the need to advocate for social support. We all deserve the resources to be able to thrive in our community. And she talked a little bit about how that shows up. Does it mean longer maternity leave, better insurance, and other structures? These are systems and structures that we require to thrive. It should not just be folks with good insurance, who live in a great neighborhood, who have the right OBGYN, who happen to deliver this way or who look this way or who love this way, who should have all of the resources that they need during pregnancy, during their labor, and when they return to their community to take care of themselves, their new baby, and the children that they may already have. Those are really important points.
Gosh, there's so much I'm trying to get to, because this is such an important conversation. One of the things that it struck me by what Raisa just shared, what you have shared, is something that we are constantly discussing on this program as it relates to the services and the treatment in our communities, and that has to do with cultural competency, whether it has to do with the education of our children, whether it has to do with community policing, or whether it has to do with receiving health services. And I would venture to say that you don't have to be a person of color to serve or to treat a person medically, but you still have to be culturally competent.
So if I could offer an alternative frame for that, the idea of cultural competency is one that we thought about in the medical space maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that framing is slightly problematic in that it suggests that you could ever be competent in someone's culture, right? And so the way that that I think about what you described is not around competency, but around humility. Understanding that we all have so much to learn about the person in front of us to be able to provide culturally responsive and quality healthcare services. And that's really what we're talking about. I agree completely that it behooves any of us who are providing care in a community to be grounded in the lived experience of those in the community. We are not doing a service to any of the people we care for if we are separated and disconnected from those that we are charged with providing services to. And that you're right, that's not just specific to healthcare providers. That's also the way we think about policing in our community and the way that we're hearing conversations about pushing back on that narrative around surveillance and the need for a carceral state. All of these things are connected. So whether we're talking about violence in our community or the disparate impact of COVID in our community, or maternal mortality, they're all grounded in the same systems that we have to work to push against to demand the care that we deserve from a human rights frame.
Well said, well said. Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Corinne calling from Ellicott City. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
My question is basically, how can we as women advocate for ourselves or for other women? You know, certainly, obviously, there's issues, but the issue is, what can we do? What is our power?
Doctor?
We have so much. We have so much. I think that the caller just before made a wonderful point about making sure that you find someone who's listening. I'll acknowledge, though, that the ability to keep changing providers and keep shopping around is often grounded in a privileged experience, right? The fact that you have a litany of providers who take your insurance and you can have access to, and you don't have to take six buses, right? So there is some of that is determined by your life circumstances. But I think that she's on the right track in saying you deserve to have someone who is listening to what you say. And if it is not this person, then we need to start looking for someone else and making that demand. I think the other thing that I would suggest in terms of individual agency and autonomy is accountability model. So you have to talk with your provider, your insurance carrier, and demand that when you are not getting the care that you need and you deserve, that providers are held accountable, right? And so that's a difficult thing to do, but it's an important thing to do. I think one of the biggest mistakes that many of us make as patients, even me, right, as a healthcare provider going in to see other healthcare providers as a patient, is to assume that we are in a position of powerlessness. This person in front of us does not know nearly as much about our bodies, about our lives, about our circumstances as we do. And so we must insist in these encounters that we remain the expert in our own life, and understanding that the healthcare provider is there to assist us in navigating these health circumstances or situations in the way that we deem best. And finding someone who is actually listening to you is a really good start.
Thank you, caller, so much for your phone call. I want to start with some really foundational stuff, though, because one of the things is, and tell me if I'm missing a point here, but pregnancy in and of itself, no matter what your socioeconomic background, your color, is an extremely risky process, particularly as it relates to what is happening to a woman's body during not just the first trimester, but the second and third trimester. Can you kind of give me a pregnancy 101 here as to what is going on, not only with the development of the baby that is risky, but also what's happening with the other organs as the baby begins to develop?
So I think that there are a couple of ways that I think it's important to think about pregnancy and delivery. One, I think that we all are under the belief that pregnancy is inherently risky because of the medicalization of pregnant people's bodies and the birth process. The reality is that the vast majority of pregnancies are safe and uncomplicated, and mom and baby are fine. But what we've seen is that as we've moved pregnancy and delivery more and more into a highly medicalized space, we have begun to believe that it is inherently dangerous and risky and, as a result, must be managed, right?
What does that mean, highly medicalized state?
So that means all of the monitoring you get when you go to the hospital to have your baby, the external monitoring, the IV, the counting the baby's heart rate, in and out to check you and sort of not allowing the person's body to do what it's designed to do. That's not to say that there are not complications that can arise or there are not issues that may need to be managed, but we're in this vicious cycle of over-medicalizing pregnancy and delivery, and as a result, we're seeing more interventions. One of the things that you can watch, it's a very clear indicator of this, is the rate of cesarean in this country, and it's going to be higher in some places than others, and some cities and others and some states and some communities, but much of that is tied to the way we think about pregnancy as inherently dangerous. So now your body changes a lot during pregnancy. So what both of the things that you said are true. There is a tension here. Pregnancy does not necessarily, is not necessarily inherently dangerous, but there are a lot of changes that the pregnant person's body undergoes in order to carry this pregnancy. Increases in blood volume, changes in blood pressure, sometimes changes in blood sugar. So some women may become diabetic when they weren't, right? And so there are changes that every pregnant person's body undergoes. And some people may be at greater risk. But for everyone across the board, I would not sort of paint with a broad brush and say that pregnancy is dangerous for many people. What we do know is that, you know, individuals who are healthy going into pregnancy often have very healthy pregnancies, often have very healthy deliveries, and their babies are also healthy. But that determination of your health going in is shaped by so much of your circumstances.
But help me with something, because we've spent, the lion's share of this conversation talking about, access to health care, being your own advocate, making sure that you're asking the right questions, telling the doctor how you're feeling. But now you're talking about the over-medicalization. So where's the balance?
Where is the balance? I think that's a really good question. It's hard to find that balance, to figure out where you fall along the spectrum. And I think that that's where communication with your provider comes in. What we're seeing in many communities where we're seeing improvements in birth outcomes is a stronger partnership between OBGYNs and midwives and labor support people, for example, allowing folks to move through the process in a way that is safe and comfortable for them, understanding that should things change and there are complications, and that person also deserves the care to be able to move through this. Balance is a tricky thing in life and certainly during pregnancy and delivery. But my point, I think, more than anything, is that we have to actively, despite hearing so many negative statistics, push back against this narrative that Black women are broken and are inherently unhealthy, and that's why this is happening to us, right? I think that we all deserve to be able to care for in a way that is holistic and complete and culturally responsive, and also deserve to have the resources to be able to be healthy going in to the pregnancy and to go home on time. But these things that are happening to us are not because we are broken and this is a dangerous process, but that the supports aren't there to allow us to move through it in a whole way.
And just to be clear, I wasn't suggesting that it was dangerous. I said risky, and not for black women, but for all women. You know, and I wanted to talk about just, you know, foundationally, you know, it is, you know, most women don't spend all of their lives pregnant, you know, and it is a major change, you know, in the body. And so now I'm not suggesting that it is dangerous, but it is risky, and it is not the place where most women, adult women, spend, you know, the majority of their lives. And it is a major physiological undertaking.
For sure. For sure. It absolutely is. There are physical changes that your body undergoes during pregnancy and immediately after delivery that can put you at greater risk for some outcomes, for sure. And it can be a risky process for some folks. But I think that we have to look to the resources that are there to support us. So, you know, after you deliver your baby and go home, then how long are you able to recover before you have to go back to work? Is your maternity leave 6 weeks and then you're back and running because you don't have health insurance that allows you to stay home and care for yourself in the way that you need? Does that mean that your pregnancy is risky or that your circumstances are unsupportive? I think about myself. I was pregnant during my residency, and I was working 80 hours a week at 30 weeks pregnant, and thinking about what my circumstances were and whether or not it was the pregnancy that was risky or my circumstances that were. And so there's no easy answer, I think, for any of us in determining what's risky and what's not. But the one thing that is clear is that folks need more support than they're getting to be able to be healthy.
Okay. Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Sharita calling from Waldorf. Thanks for holding on. What's on your mind?
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
My name is Sharita Gaines Collins. I am with Healthy Families of Southern Maryland, which is a home visiting program. And I think that's very important for a lot of women, especially black women, with the high infant mortality rates. A lot of people are not as familiar with some of the home visiting programs. Some feel that it's just for, you know, women if they don't have a lot of money or a lot of resources, but we're open to anyone. You know, we do discuss with them to advocate for themselves. I'm very interested in this topic because it's a big thing to me, especially with, you know, minority women and myself being a minority woman, and just seeing how the different health disparities, and encouraging women to, you know, continue to go out and speak for yourself, trying to get some who receive medical assistance to know you can change your doctor if you need to. You have that right. You know, a lot of people aren't very aware of the rights that they have as patients or clients. A lot of the doctors are not always sharing the necessary information. I run into that with many of my clients, that a lot of information, especially through their pregnancy, and then even into the fourth trimester after they have the baby, is not shared. You know, you have women, like the previous caller said, returning back to work. And even with us as black women, that perception, that historical perception from even slavery, how we would have babies and then you back on working in the field. Mm-hmm. And a lot of women have just continued to carry that through. But to know, you know, to look at your support systems, to look and not to be afraid to advocate, not to be afraid to ask questions, but also the visibility of programs such as the one that I work for, I think they need to be more visible. And I think, you know, and people really need to see how accessible they are and how helpful they are in providing information and following you through the pregnancy. We follow through the whole pregnancy all the way until the child is 5 years old.
Okay.
Where it's not just, you know, not just educating on pregnancy, but other aspects, because those perceptions, you know, are often misguided because there's so much misinformation out there
Yeah.
So we try to make sure people are getting the correct information.
Well, thank you so much, Sharita, for sharing with us. Dr. Perry, do you want to speak on what
thank
she
you
was
for,
sharing with
yes,
us?
Yes, I would love to. It's a wonderful program, and we're hearing more and more about perinatal support, which is what we're talking about. It includes things like home visits. And so the Healthy Families Program in Maryland is a wonderful example of that, understanding that your journey does not end when you leave the hospital, that there are supports that folks need to be able to have access to in order to survive this time and to make sure that their new child and their community continues to thrive. I think that that's a really good point. The other thing that I want to just to say another word about is this question of rights, your rights as a patient. And so we cannot stress that enough. There are rights that you have in this situation. The power and privilege that is built into and upheld by our medical system is an important thing to flip over, right? And this isn't work that can be done with sensitivity training or implicit bias courses, but acknowledging this power dynamic that plays up, that plays out, that causes individuals to be disempowered in our clinical encounters. And so she spoke absolutely perfectly about these rights, the right to be listened to, the right to change providers, the right to demand care that you need and you deserve. And those are important things to remember.
Let me go back to the phone lines. Cassandra, calling from Suitland, what's on your mind?
Hi. So it's amazing, this whole conversation. All of it spanned across my time when I was pregnant with my daughter. I'm not going to go through all of it, but I just want to make a couple of points. One, I had a miscarriage. 3 months later, I got pregnant with my daughter, and then I had her 10 weeks early. And through none of that time was I ever told was something physically wrong with me. I had my daughter, nothing was told. Then at the age, my daughter was 19, I ended up having a hysterectomy. And then the white male doctor that gave me the hysterectomy told me I had all kinds of things going on in my body. But the black popular female OBGYN I had at that time didn't tell me anything. So I personally feel like it's an issue of providers listening to their patients. It's providers being knowledgeable and communicating the issues to their patients.
Yeah. Excellent point. Doctor?
I mean, I'd co-sign it. It's all true. So much of it is determined by your provider, which is unfortunate. And that has a lot. That is because these aren't conversations that we're having in medical school and residency at a large scale. So we're teaching OBGYNs how to deliver babies, how to do hysterectomies, how to do all kinds of procedures, but not how to have conversations in a way that's meaningful and can change the game for the folks that we're taking care of. You know, for me, you know, what that comes down to is asking ourselves as healthcare providers, and it doesn't matter if you are a black OBGYN as I am, or a white OBGYN. We all, as the first caller said, were raised in the same system. And so we have to ask ourselves how we are complicit in upholding these systems that don't serve us and don't serve our communities. And she spoke to a wide range of issues, from miscarriage to preterm delivery to hysterectomies, all things that black women are more likely to experience than white women. And the question becomes, why are these outcomes existing in our communities, and what can be done about them?
Oh, gosh. I'm almost out of time. We need to bring you back.
But, anytime.
Some final thoughts for you on this issue as it relates to, you know, moving forward for women who are listening, who either are pregnant or thinking about becoming pregnant.
What I would say is that, you know, speaking in my OBGYN hat, I know that we all have a responsibility in this field to do the work to undo what we're seeing now, and to name what we're seeing now as the consequence of centuries of oppression. That's what this is. And as a black woman who's seeking care for myself, for my family, for
loved ones, friends who are contemplating pregnancy, who are currently pregnant, then I know that all of us have to be active advocates for ourselves in every way that's possible. There are lots of organizations and resources that are lifting up these issues. The Black Mamas Matter Alliance is one that is led and centers the needs of Black women and has been sounding the alarm for years on this issue. So we're working to elevate this issue, to call for resources. The Black Maternal Health Caucus in Congress, being led by amazing representatives, is working on this. And certainly here in D.C., we're actively working on shifting these inequities in a way to sustain our communities. You know, I came to medicine as a liberatory practice for myself and for my community. And I know that this means constantly interrogating the way we provide care and demanding that we do better. I believe that we can and we must.
That's a great way to end this conversation. Always a work in progress, but more importantly, the work needs to be done. Dr. Jamila Parrott, I want to thank you so much for talking to us and sharing your expertise and your insight. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it as well.
Absolutely. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, July 13th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.